right, or as we say in Birmingham, light. we're coming to the, this is our last talk together, and I'd like to throw it open. But just a quick summary is, you know, obviously I've been trying to present you with a practice which some of you have had in place for a while, got some familiarity with, and some of you I think it's quite new and quite revolutionary, I would say, and very much challenges the way that the practice, the way you practice for quite some time. That doesn't make it bad, but it makes it a it brings a perspective that hitherto that you've not been aware of, especially learning to practice in the body and how important that is, and all the practices that you've been using over the years, by all means, if you wish to carry on with those, but actually you can now bring all of those into your body as well. The whole of the Dharma can be practiced in the body, every type of practice, however conceptual and intricate it is, you can bring all of those into your body, and you will find that they will become a lot richer and a lot more real, a lot more grounded, and the fruit from those practices you'll be able to take into your life. So hopefully there's benefit all round from all different perspectives. And just coming back to the fundamental principle of all Dharma practice, this is what unites all practices, is that essentially and ultimately it is about awareness. Awareness is the jewel in the crown. Awareness is that which unlocks the door, opens the door to freedom and to peace. We've chosen to approach it in a particular way, but the principle is the same in all practices. And I just hope that, you know, you've been able to appreciate the non sort of dogmatic, non-judgmental way of this type of practice, the way it really is a one of spaciousness and openness, a one of total and complete inclusivity. No picking and choosing. There is no compromise with that. There's no exception. Everything is practice. Everything is to be opened up to. When you open up to all of your experiences, you are actually opening up to yourself. However much they may seem to be out there somewhere, you are actually learning to open up to yourself, possibly in a way that's never been possible before. And learn to embrace that experience, and through perseverance, through familiarity, through a willingness to bear with, this is how we slowly learn to make friends with ourselves. And that is what Dharma is about. It's about making friends and learning to like ourselves. And this practice, I think you'll appreciate, is very direct. It doesn't beat about the bush at all. It doesn't lose itself in little avenues going this way and going that way. We don't divert. We don't turn away from anything. We completely open up and say yes. We say yes to life, and we say yes to ourselves in a completely open and inclusive way. And that really is the heart and spirit. And if you can learn to grow into that mode, and it's something that we have to learn to grow into, you will be able to take that to every practice that you will ever encounter, and every aspect, every mode of your life and existence with others and with yourself. You'll be able to take this fully and completely. So I hope that's got home anyway. I hope that's been realised, and I hope you'll be able to really make use of this practice. So, without me going on yet again, I'd just like to finish, if any of you have got any questions, any little things that are, you know, niggling you, you're not quite sure about, you don't feel quite comfortable about. Now's the time to speak. And if you don't, then you'll have to keep it till the next time we meet.
It's about the kind of continuity between sitting practice and pure awareness practice and non-sitting. The difference I've noticed is that I think because the sitting practice is so bounded in time and space, i.e. to sit still for 40 minutes, I think that really helps me to kind of hold what's going on. And like particularly the afternoons, which is a kind of wider stretch of time, but I'm thinking kind of back in London and stuff as well, experience is much tougher to hold what's going on, get distracted, dispersed. And I just wondered if you could share some of your kind of reflections or thoughts about how we could approach that.
At home,
yeah.
Well, as I said at the beginning, that this is a golden opportunity. This is really the definition of Sangha, that helps to support us as we learn to open up to ourselves. This is exactly, this to me is what Sangha is really about. It isn't about having cups of tea and going to the cinema, and which is all great things to be doing, but that's, I think, really missing the heart of what Sangha is about. It's about supporting, to feeling that support, so that we can build the courage, if you like, to let go, or to step where we've never stepped before, to take that step into the unknown, is what Sangha allows us to do. And that to me is tremendous. And if we can create an environment where that makes it possible for us, I think that is just, well, as I say, tremendous. But of course we don't have that when we're on our own. I think it makes us appreciate Sangha that much more when we are on our own. And for sure it's true that it is more difficult to apply ourselves to the practice, to bring ourselves to the practice, because we are pulled around all over the place. As we all know, we all get caught up in things, and forces are forever pulling us this way and that way. That's why the monastic tradition was created. I mean, all spiritual tradition practices have a monastic branch for that very reason, for those that don't want to be distracted, so they can go into sort of a permanent state of Sangha, if you like. That's that extreme, and for us people who choose not to do that, all I can say about that is that it comes back to commitment, is to really try to bring yourself to every situation, try to bring that awareness to every situation. And something that I do know definitely on a practical level that helps, and helps that enormously, is to have a routine in your life, to have a structure in your life, if it's at all possible with the sort of work that you do, so that you get up at a particular time and certain times of the day, you do this, you should be doing this and should be doing that. And have that structure in your life, so that does help to support you while you're being pulled around by different options and different things to do. And often, taking the easy way, taking the nice way, the things that we want to do, and avoiding the things that, are not so attractive. By having that structure, we know what we're supposed to be doing at a certain time of the day. And, at times we can resent that, but actually that is a very good, supportive, skillful way of practicing. In a sense, that's almost like Sangha. You do have that support around you, so that it does help to keep you, so that when you've got these temptations of, the slothfulness, and you just can't be bothered, and manana, and all that sort of stuff, you know that, at this time of the day, I'm doing this. And that helps you, takes you out of that mara of choice, and puts you, and brings you to what you know you should be doing. And I say we can resent it often, simply because we don't want to do these things, but actually from a practice point of view, it's, I think it's really essential, actually. I mean, not all of us, I guess not everybody has a job, as a lifestyle where you do have that rather predictable daily routine. But for those of us that do, and that's certainly most of us, it is a very skillful thing to put in place. And if you're somebody that doesn't have any commitment on a daily basis, work, any sort of commitment at all, where basically you please yourself, some, I guess you're financially free or whatever, where you know you don't work, you don't have any commitments, where you you go to bed when you like and you get up when you like and you do what you like whenever you feel like doing, and then try to say, well, you know, this is great, I'm practicing the Dharma, I just think, boy, you're really, really kidding yourself. This is called self-indulgence, when we just do what we want to do when we want to do it. There's no strength there. It's just willfulness. It's just self-indulgence, and you cannot in any way bring Dharma to that type of way of living. And you do. You're always meeting people who are like that, and they sit. Sometimes they won't, but sit when it suits them, and you know, get up when they want, etc. I don't think that's at all useful in practicing the Dharma. I think to have a regular routine, at least 6 days a week. Let go on the seventh if you wish. At least 6 days a week where you are bringing that discipline to your life, and bring it to your situation, bring it to your everyday circumstances as things come and go during the day, is so helpful, is so supportive. That I would suggest. And the other thing that I would also suggest that we need to do in our life, we can actually go the other way, especially us Westerners, we're so busy, we're so caught up, we're so committed to so many things that we're running around like blue-ass flies most of the time, hardly having any time to settle, is to, in our day, providing we can do it, most of us can, unless we're just really caught up with commitments that demand otherwise, to create a space of 1 or 2 hours a day where we do nothing. Just be still and be with yourself. Gather yourself up. Just collect yourself that's been pulled and scattered around all your activities and all the experiences and temptations and stuff that we get on a daily basis. Just stop, take a deep breath and gather yourself up and just be with yourself. I mean, this is a process of learning to make friends with yourself. As I've said over and over again, I think that's the absolute bottom line with what we're doing, is that we're learning to make friends with ourselves. Well, until we're actually prepared to just be with ourselves and settle with ourselves, then how on earth are we ever going to get to know ourselves and get to be friendly with ourselves? And just doing nothing for an hour or two a day, for a lot of people, is something that they don't want to do. It's frightening, actually. We need to be doing something. We need to be filling the space up, being productive, producing something, making use of my time. This is all conditioning, and it takes hold of us to the extent that if we discover we've got nothing to do for an hour or two, it can be quite frightening. I mean, it can frighten us, and we want to, I must think of something to do, or get on the telephone and make an arrangement to see somebody, and you know, rather than be on my own. It's where loneliness could really begin to show itself in situation, and it's that sort of experience that we need to learn to make friends with, not run away from, not fill the gap. And this, I should have mentioned earlier, if you look on the timetable, you know, that time after lunch, between lunch and 4 o'clock, just to be with yourself, that is not a waste of time. That is quality dharmic practice time of doing nothing. And just being with yourself, learning to be comfortable in your own company, learning to declutch from what is nothing more than a social conditioning of doing things and achieving things, but just learn to let go of all of that and just be still, do nothing, see what it feels like to do nothing, because that shouldn't be a problem. because that's our natural state, but it is a problem for a lot of us. Bring that to your life. Have that in your day. So however, you know, however busy you are and however productive and positive, you know, things that you do in your day, let the whole lot go and just be. Just potter around. Darn your socks. Be, look out the window. Be with yourself. Nothing special. And learn to get comfortable with that. I think most of us don't find that comfortable, to be honest. There's this sort of a frustration that builds up. And then if we're in a particular emotional state at the time, the last thing we want is to be in, because then we get this sense of, get this experience of loneliness. And, you know, that experience of loneliness is a really awful experience, and we don't want it. We don't want it. And the society, the culture that we live in doesn't encourage us to be on our own. It encourages us to be busy, 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 busy. Well, when you're busy, 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 you're never going to get to know yourself. That's a simple, basic rule of what this is about. When you're busy, you're being pulled all over. You're being taken away from the very centre that we are aspiring to come to. So in your life, I would say, find a structure. As much as you can, stick to the structure. So you know when the alarm clock goes off at 6 o'clock, you've got to get up. Not lie there and think, oh, well, I get up a bit later, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whatever. You get up at 6 o'clock and learn to carry the resistance through having to do something that you don't want to do, and learn to work, open up to that emotion experience that will come with these, with a routine, to stay with a routine, so you know what to do at certain times of the day, so you don't have this picking and choosing and doing manipulating your day to suit you, so that, you know, so that it becomes easy for you. Coupled with creating a space in your day when you're not doing anything particular, when you're pottering around or just doing nothing, sitting with yourself, and learn to be with yourself and learn to be comfortable with yourself. And this period in the afternoon, that's what it was designed to do. Because meditation, you know, you can say, well, I sit and I meditate and I'm with myself. But meditation could become just another thing to do, another thing to produce, in the same way that, you know, you could go to work and manufacture something. You can sit on your cushion and manufacture your meditation. You get a sense of doing something when you sit. So you can't use that as an excuse to be on your own. That's fine, and of course that's... That's a part of our day, and that's an essential part. But I think there should be another part of the day when we're on our own, when we really know that we're not actually achieving anything. And see what that feels like. And you learn so much about yourself, so much about yourself. And just learn about your limitations of how you just can't just be. How difficult that can be. Learn to do that. That, I think, that's a part of your commitment, that routine and that willingness to be with yourself will help to support you in our worldly lives that most of us have got. But I think it's important to put structure, and that structure is a gesture of our commitment. And work with it as best you can, and then come to Sangha as often as you can.
Just before I ask my question, there was a little quotation, just comparing it on what you've just been saying, there was a little quotation that I once heard on a radio program. That loneliness is the need for another, but alone is happy with the self.
Thank you.
When you talk about bringing the practice out of the head and down into the body, I have a bit of a problem actually understanding what this is it a physical thing that actually drops into the body, or do you mean sort of working out of the body and allowing the practice to come to the outside world so that you live the practice rather than just imagining the practice?
Well, imagining the practice, then you're in your head, which is what you've been doing, spending your whole life imagining. That's what we do, and that's why things are the way they are. To come into the body requires awareness, which most of us don't have a lot of the time. And when we do have awareness, somehow there isn't that connection with the body. But actually, when you're in awareness, you are actually in the body. But by aspiring to come to awareness and to know that it's in the body, and by coming back and actually with awareness, actually coming back and realizing that you do have a physical form, and actually come back into that form. And if you happen to be doing something, which we are most of the time, be aware of the movement. Be aware that you've got arms and you've got legs. Be aware of the feelings. There's always a feeling there, even if it's a neutral one, because you'd be dead if you didn't have, if you were numb. You're not numb. Awaken your awareness to that, to those feelings, and also to the emotions, and learn to abide in that space, and learn to recognize it. Learn to realize that there is all of this which is a part of you, because actually most of us don't. I can say that, and you can say yes, but somehow it's like, by the way, the world's up here, and everything that's important is all up here, and it's all about playing up here with what's going on up here, and living life up here, and doing everything up here. Of course, we got you, but we don't be expressive life. It all is up, and we have ourselves, body, and that way we begin to become alive again, maybe for the first time, to come in contact like with our emotions and what our emotions, because often we avoid our emotions a lot of the time. We don't recognize our emotions, and we don't recognize them as sort of part of me, and when they're around, they're things that we want to avoid for the most part. Is that we have to learn to turn around, as it were, and open up to those and say yes, that these are my emotions, this is the way I am. And all of that takes place in the body. That's not a mental, that's a direct experience, that's a direct impact. And learning, because you're willing to do so, learn more and more to come into the body. And what happens when you come into the body is that you do become present with what's in front of you. We lose what's in front. I can be drinking this cup of water like this, and I can be chattering to you, and I can actually just like mechanically pick that up and drink it and put down, and not be aware that there's been something has actually taken place, that there's actually been a physical act that's actually just taken place, because I am so caught up here, I have no awareness at all. It's not been my experience. And that's what we learn to grow into, so that when I pick the cup up, I know I'm picking up the cup. I mean, it's not a big deal, is it? We do it all the time, but at least I'm aware that I'm drinking the water, and that's taking us into the body. So by learning to come to whatever's in front of us, whatever we're doing, drinking the water, sitting on the cushion, or listening to me, doing physical things, working and just moving around, your willingness to be alive, not to be caught in a fantasy world where you can walk from one end of a street to another and not even know you've taken the walk, not have absolutely no clue as to the environment that you've just passed through, with the cars and the atmosphere and the noise and the people. You can walk one length of a road, a busy road, one to the other, and be so locked in your own world that you're not aware of any of that. That's what we're training ourselves to, let go of that and come back into what's nothing special. Just be aware that you're walking down the road. It's no big deal, is it? But this is how we willingly turn away from the seduction of the mind and the fantasy world, the world that we create up here, and learn to come back into that which is, as I've tried to point out, is actually what we really are. This is a fantasy. This is, if it's anything sort of real in that regard, this is real. It's all here. Everything is here. And that trains us bit by bit to come into the body. And when we come into the body, we will naturally we will draw all of this stuff up here, and we will begin to become reintegrated. We will reintegrate mind and body, and we will begin to become whole again. And that's the path that we're on. It is such a revolutionary thing that we do, is that we're actually willing to turn ourselves around from a habit that we've had all of our lives, and actually come right back into the very basis, into the very foundation of what we are. And when we return there, when we are returning there, this is where we begin to genuinely begin to understand ourselves, not in a dualistic sort of analytical way of breaking up and putting labels on things, but actually get to know ourselves in a very direct way, before thinking, before concepts. And this is the process of wholeness, of coming back into the whole. And awareness is the key. Awareness is that which allows us to embark upon that journey. But the way that we grow into it, that we know it intellectually, that this is, and we can learn to come into that awareness when we're on our cushion. But as I say, when we're in our daily life, as maybe we can discover this afternoon, when we're doing all these physical things that we're going to be asked to do, just come in. If you're washing up, just come and be aware that you're washing up. Come in, and when you have that awareness, when you're really experiencing that activity without putting label, I don't want to do this washing up, why should I do this, this is women's job, what am I doing it for, and the hot water's too cold anyway and it's dirty, and why am I doing this, I'm doing it at home, I've got to come in, I've got to, all of that, and actually have no awareness, no experience at all of what actually we're doing, this mechanical thing is going on, but rather drop all of that with awareness, don't buy into that, and then with awareness bring yourself into body, bring yourself into the hot water, into the cold water, bring yourself into the plates and the cups that you're washing, and then when you go off, come back into the, and when you do that, you're in your body. You're experiencing as a direct impact, before thinking, you know, the Zen koan, before thinking of good or bad. Before thinking of good or bad, be with what's in front of you. This is so concrete. This is so on the ground. This is absolutely that. That's where we should be. There. Not up here. Not up here that takes us up into the clouds and away from ourselves, away from what we are, and by learning to come back into what's in front of us, into the everyday, nothing special, there's never anything special, but invariably we are engaged with things, to come back with what's in front of us will bring us back into our body, will nurture that potential of reintegration. And when we're in our body, very much as hopefully we learn as we go, this is where truth is, this is where liberation is, to see that liberation is in the body, liberation is not in the head, that is a delusion, that liberation is in the form, and if you can accept that is true, then you're going to want to come into the body, you're going to want to aspire to turn that ship around and go in the other direction and come back down into the body, because that's where release is, that's where freedom, that's where peace is, that's where wisdom is, that's where we go beyond the cycle of birth and death. It's in the body. In the body. Everything is in the body, and there is nothing in the head worth thinking about.
Can I just add something to that? Because I think it's very easy to kind of like picking up the cup or walking along the street. It's a bit, like you were saying, to sort of think I'm picking up the cup, or, I mean, making the difference between thinking about what the body is doing and actually the sense of, you know, just the simple sensation of, the, you know, as Dave was saying, the hot, the cold. You know, if you just feel it in your hand, you can just feel
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's all.
So it's very simple.
There's nothing special.
Yeah.
These are things that we do every day. We're always looking for something special, something profound. But actually, it's not profound. It's sitting on the end of our nose.
I was to say, it's not surprising that we're looking for something profound, which is why we're sort of
looking yeah. Head yeah. Head. Yeah. Well, we're looking in the wrong direction. We've lost it. It's called delusion. It's called ignorance. That, you know, it's like we're trying to go home, and instead of going home, you know, home is this way. We turn around and we're going that way, and wonder why we can't find home. We just wander and wander and wander and wander. And then think, well, that's because we're going in the right direction.
Expanding on this, it's been my experience that most of the people I meet in my ordinary everyday life are either living in the past or they're living in the future. And occasionally, very occasionally, they pass through the present, but very quickly, so that they can then move on to the past or the future again. Now I understand that when you're talking about the body, you're talking about being in the moment, which centres you exactly where you are. It was this thing about the body. The thing about being in the moment, yes, I can relate to that absolutely immediately. Yeah, it's about being here and now rather than somewhere else.
And the irony of that is that when we're in the past and when we're in the future, we're actually in this moment anyway.
Yeah, you can't be in the past.
There is only this moment. But by golly, we do our best not to recognise it. We do our damnedest. And we keep it going for a whole lifetime. Anything but this moment.
So is there certain activities which are kind of useful to do then, in terms of encouraging, but not especially?
I think it depends. No, not really. I think it depends. You know, if you've got really strong attachments to doing particular things, and you always get very, very caught up and carried away by those things, they would be the most difficult things to. But I think what is a very important principle in all Dharma practice is that you don't go looking for things. You don't try to set up things intentionally. I mean, after all, who's the one that's setting these things up? And clearly you're meant to be trying to achieve something by doing that. Life will present itself to you moment by moment. It will always be presenting mysteriously. Things will. None of us know how we're going to be in 5 minutes' time. Mm. Exactly. Well, you know, pretty sure we're going to be unless you get up and walk out. But you know, our feelings and what's actually how we are, we're not going to know. And it's not about looking, and it's not about doing anything particular, anything special. It's. I mean, this is a part of the spirit of this type of practice is that we accept whatever's in front of us without picking and choosing. That's good, bad, that's right and wrong, what have you, is to learn to open up to literally everything. Whatever's in front of us is where the practice is.
Thinking activities that say are pleasurable Mm-hmm. Might be more interesting.
Well, they will be, but then, you know, you're chasing pleasure all the time. What are you going to do? Just have pleasurable experiences all the time. I mean, if you could do that, you wouldn't be sitting in here, would you? I mean, you'd be a bit daft. I wouldn't be here anyway. Not. If I could keep some of my experiences going forever. Now that's an important principle, because again, you know, you might, oh, well, I really must be doing something again. You know, I must be. Just take life as it opens up to you. I mean, what does become evident, what you do become aware of, is that clearly some situations are more skillful than others. I mean, this does nurture the ethical side of things, where you begin to. It's not sort of wholly a passive thing, is that you do realise that some things are more skillful than others, and especially, you know, how you define ethics. You know, it's about, to me, ethics is about harming others and harming yourself. And if you find that that's the what you're going into, and then maybe you just begin to restrain a bit, because that's clearly, you know, that's unskillful. But having said that, if you still get caught up in your stuff, the Buddha is still there. The Buddha's there waiting to be found in whatever you do, any situation. The Buddha doesn't pick and choose. In every single moment, it's whether it's possible to aspire to that insight while you're caught up with something that's really washed over you. That's the point. It is not the specific thing itself, not in terms of Dharma and wisdom and understanding, because it's there in every single moment. The door is to be opened in every moment. Whatever you're doing, literally whatever you're doing, it's just that some things we may be doing will be so powerful. That possibility is not going to be there. So we learn to temper ourselves, to create the conditions, so that these things become more possible.
One thing that Sam Ratchito suggested that I've certainly found useful is to pause between doing one activity and another, so that you kind of mark the ending of doing something before you start something else. Yeah. You have a moment of mindfulness where it's obviously an opportunity where you can become aware of how ethical whatever you've been talking about or doing has just been, and you collect yourself for whatever you're going to do, and you can do that just quite simply, you know, with 30 seconds or a minute of pause in between one thing and another, even if it's just, you know, having a cup of tea before you go and make bed or whatever.
As long as you don't get caught up in your analysing and your judgments of what you've done. That can easily turn into something, you know, another analytical, judgmental. I mean, I agree, it's good to stop, to pause, to take a deep breath is always a skillful thing to do anyway, just to sort of pull yourself back. But I think in terms of the spirit of this type of practice, you know, then to sort of get into some what would be a habit anyway, sort of an analytical of good and bad, right and wrong, and stuff like that.
Oh, I certainly wasn't.
No.
It's more like, for example, let's say you've had a conversation you weren't very happy with, even if you don't.
Oh yeah, you can reflect on it. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't have to reflect. It might be just like a bodily uncomfortableness. Mm. So it's a much more body-based thing. You don't have to think about it. You know, it's an opportunity in a way that awareness can come into whatever you
to establish itself.
about you were talking about earlier about kind of putting a structure in your life, which I basically got, but and I usually kind of meditate in the evening, for example. But if I'm planning to go out in the evening, then obviously I have to change that. And the extent to which that's kind of acceptable within what we're doing. I mean, I get the sense that that's fair enough. You know, maybe I meditate at lunchtime now and then, but if I get that, if it goes too far, then it's obviously the structure's kind of become a bit floppy, if you like, isn't it?
I mean, you've got, you know, there's nothing fixed, and you can't be silly about this. I mean, the way life is, that things come along that make us drop what we're going to do, what we wanted to do. I mean, this happens quite a lot, you know, when we're living in the world, and we're caught up with lots of things. But you know, the fact that, you know, if you want to go to the cinema tonight at 8 o'clock, and that's when you sit. Well, personally, I'd sit before, because I want to go to the cinema, and I still sit. I mean, you've got to be sensible about this. Oh, no, I can't go to the cinema, I've got to meditate. When you can actually fit it in, because you're not going to do that all the time. That's not what you do as a matter of course. That's due to a particular circumstance, and you go with the circumstance. But you know yourself, if you're just compromising all over the place, and you know, you're finding any excuse to break your structure, and that's for you to decide, and you know if that's true or not. But I don't think you have to deny, you know, these sorts of things that come along. And sometimes, like I say, sometimes things that come along will just sweep it all away. You suddenly find you've got to go and see somebody's sick or whatever, I don't know, where you've got to go off and spend the day going and coming, and the whole thing goes out the window. Well, that's okay also. Because you can get attached to your routine too. You can get attached to anything. Oh, this is my practice, I can't do this. I've got to be doing this now. That's not the spirit. You know, as I've said earlier, you've got to learn to play with things. Learn to, you know, be committed, but at the same time, not, oh, it's got to be like this. Because that's not, that type of rigidity. That's not Dharma, that's not the middle way, that's not the spirit of Dharma. But the other, you know, the other extreme is that you've become too slack, and you look for any excuse. And that's where your own personal commitment comes, you know. And you have to keep, I think it's true, you have to keep refreshing and keep looking at yourself and what you're doing, and refresh yourself and polish yourself up a bit. Keep it going.
My personal experience might be of some help here. The kind of work that I do, I work at Manchester Airport, and the hours that I work are governed by when aircraft come in and when aircraft go out. Which means that, for instance, one day I could be starting at 5 o'clock in the morning. The following day I could be starting at 6 o'clock in the morning. The day after that it could be 6:30 in the morning. The day after that it could be 2:30 in the afternoon. So I have to be flexible. I have to adapt my sitting and the arrangements of the house. I live by myself and therefore I take care of myself. And I have to work around my work schedule. So what I've learned is flexibility. What I've learned is to adapt my life to the periods that I work, because they are reasonably fixed in the sense that I have to go to work at this time and I come home at this time. That may help, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think you've got quite an unusual situation. Most of us aren't sort of chopping and changing on a daily basis. But sure, you know, if you're on shift work, then obviously things have got to, you know, you've got to go with those circumstances, because I mean, in a sense, well, in the real sense, they're out of your control anyway, because you know, you are told you know, when to go to work and when not to go to work. So obviously you have to shape yourself around that. But that's not like your free will. That's different to, I go to work at 8 o'clock today because I feel like it, or I go to work at 9 o'clock. And that's the willfulness. That's the, you know, the comfort zone of just arranging life to suit me and as comfortable as I can. When all that's, I mean, that's the great thing about having a job, rather than not having a job. When you have a job, so many of your decisions are taken out of your hands. So you don't have choice. You are told you start work at 8 o'clock. So therefore you start work, otherwise you don't have a job. So therefore you do, even though you may resent it. That's what you do, and that's the good situation to be in. So the biggest Mara that we've got, the biggest Mara that that Westerners have got, is choice. We have too many choices. We've got whatever we do, we got 10 ways, you know, we've got 10 choices to do any particular thing. And that is, from a practice point of view, is very, very undesirable. It's very unskillful. The best form of practice is when you've got no choice. And then you just do it. You don't like it, you can resent it, you can hate it, but you do it. That's the best form, where you just surrender to whatever. You know, historically Buddhism has never been practiced by people who've got choice. People are usually poor. there's very little to aspire to in their life, other than feed themselves on a daily basis. So when they come to interested in practice and maybe come to the monastery, when things they go by the structure, they go by the routine, they go by the training, and then when things get tough, when things get difficult, as they will, it's so easy for them. They don't have the choice of, oh, I'm going to leave here now, I'm going to go to another monastery, or I'm going to go and get in my car and go off somewhere, or I'm going to go on holiday, or I'm going to go down the pub and get drunk, or I'm going to do this and do that. They go, oh. They know that they just got to stay there, and they just got to stay with it. There is no choice. And that, of course, is not easy in that sense, but in another way, it is the ideal way to practice, because it takes all of those options away from you. Options are a dreadful Mara in spiritual practice, because that temptation is there all the time, and we get it in the West. And I mean, the perfect example these days is that there are so many traditions, so many teachers, so many groups across the whole Buddhist spectrum, where, you know, we were talking the other day about learning to bear with and learning to stay with your restlessness. Well, of course, you know, when restlessness comes, you know, with us people here, you think, oh, well, that's okay, I'm fed up here, I'm going to go and see a Tibetan teacher tomorrow, I'm going to go on a Tibetan retreat or a Zen retreat. And then you go there, and then you gets a bit iffy, so you just hop to the next thing, and you hop to the next. Well, as we were saying the other day, there's no change in that. Just hopping around all the time. But that's always the possibility for us people. Whereas historically in Buddhism, people were invariably born into a tradition, maybe only one tradition in their country. In fact, they didn't even know about other forms of practice. And that's what they went to, because there were no choices, they went to, and they stuck with it because there was no choice. And they stuck with it, and they stuck with it. And this is why, you know, so many people went through a lot of change. It's because they learned to bear with their restlessness and their desire to run away and do something else. And in a spiritual sense, I mean, that is absolutely ideal conditions. And that's the way it's been for thousands of years. And now it's come here and it's completely turned on its head. If we do want change, we do have to stick with things. But the way we've been brought up in our lives is that whatever we do, there's choice all the time. We go to Tesco's, you know, we go in there, we just, you know, you go and buy a tin of beans. I mean, even when I was a lad, I suspect you probably couldn't buy more than two different varieties, Heinz and Cross and Blackwell, I would imagine. But these days you go in there and you can stand in front of the baked beans for 5 minutes and you just don't know which one to pick up. Every flavour, every type, every colour, you can imagine, is there looking at you. And when you come in next time, there's another load. I mean, if that's not enough, then you come back again, there's another lot. And that's our life, isn't it? That's how our life is. And you know, from a consumer point of view, of course, it's fantastic. But in terms of a spiritual path, it's a disaster. Well, it makes it so much more difficult. And you get this, you know, bringing it much more closer to home, you get this in the spiritual world, in the Buddhist world, when you look around. It's just amazing the things, the different places that people go and got fingers in so many different pies. You know, I've been around just over 30 years, and that never existed then. You know, when I first started, when I was fortunate, I just went straight to my teacher and I was totally satisfied with that. But if I wasn't, I think there was one other place that I could have gone to. Maybe one or two more if I really, really looked. But these days, my God, it's just, you know, you've almost got, we've got people knocking on your door next. Come and join my Buddhist group. And offering all the advantages that it's got over the one that you're in at the moment. And that is just, that's a disaster against in the West. And it seems to me like it's just getting worse and worse. But what really strikes me about this is that talking to people, I mean, in my day, if anybody done this, I mean, you wouldn't really do it with my teacher, because you knew if she found out, you'd be out on your ears. So if you did do anything like that, you'd done it very quietly and you felt almost shame and you know, you hid yourself and you didn't. But these days, people just brag about it, if you like. They just say, oh, I'm going to go and do this Vipassana retreat, and then I'm going to go and some Tibetan monastery, and then I'm going to take this teacher in so-and-so, and just take that as being normal. That's what you do. This is my spiritual practice. This is my practice of the Dharma, is that I spread myself around traditions, half a dozen years of Buddhists, and everybody. My practical way in the entire history, you know, we're supposed to be taking refuge in the Arya Sangha, taking refuge in the wisdom of the saints and sages down the history. We don't take refuge in the Arya Sangha, because if we did, we would follow their example, that we would follow their teachings and try and aspire to what they offer us. And if we did, we wouldn't do all these things. But this is what we do. Taking refuge in the Arya Sangha is just an empty gesture. Actually, it's a completely empty gesture. We don't take refuge in the Arya Sangha. The one thing that we don't do. Because if we did, we wouldn't do the things that we do. But this is how it is in the West. And it's not. It's, you know, it's very difficult to work up, you know, to be positive about it. But that's the way that we are. And it's all about choices, choices, choices. Too many tins of baked beans. That's the basic problem of life. Too many tins of baked beans. It's exactly the same thing. And a child doesn't have discipline. A child just has impulses. It's just, well, it has no discipline. It hasn't learned to control itself. It doesn't learn to channel its energies. It doesn't have the wisdom. So it picks like this all the time. And then eats something like, you watch a monkey. It'll eat half of something, chuck it away and go and get another one. It won't eat the whole thing. They just want to get on. And there's no sense of discipline and form and structure within themselves. And this is what we've got to bring to practice. Otherwise it's not going to work. It's just going to be my practice and do it my way. And that's the big challenge, I think. The big challenge for us people in the West. It is a huge challenge.
You know, in your first book, David, when the centre asked you if Westerners have any particular difficulty, you didn't touch upon that, you know, to the baked beans.
Really?
Is that because back then you weren't so aware of it, did you want
to? Well, I probably wasn't eating baked beans at the time. I can't remember
you
the.
Didn't think there were any particular difficulties that Westerners had.
I wasn't looking at it from that perspective.
Yeah, well, you said Westerners fill the world with greed, hatred, and delusion, just like
Easterners. Yes.
End of story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a. You know, if you want to unpack it and pick it out, this is something that's. I suppose I was talking about. The Western makeup is not being any different. Human beings are human beings. It's our circumstance we happen to be living in, which I guess I didn't relate in quite the same way on a physical level. But that is a massive challenge. And it just comes back to that. That willingness to stay and to bear with when things come up to bear with, you know, we try to put that into practice over these few days, to stay within the form, to stay within the timetable, the structure, to learn to bear with, and all these resistances and all these temptations, to learn to not be carried by them, but to learn to bear with and to stay with those desires and that restlessness, and to stay with until it burns itself out, which maybe we've experienced. And this is how the transforming process works. It is about a discipline, it is about structure, and there's a willingness to put yourself into the middle of it and allow yourself to burn out through commitment, through ability to bear with. And that... basic principle, if you can just grasp that over these few days, you know, it then has to be taken into your life. That same bearing with needs to be taken into your life, and not just when things get a bit difficult, you go running off this way and go running off that way. Because if you do, there is no spiritual change, there's no spiritual turnover. You have nothing to support that way of practice. You have nothing whatsoever to support that way. You cannot say, you know, you've got wisdom behind you, supporting you. You've got Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are supporting the way that you decide that you want to practice. You don't have anything other than your own self and your own desire to make the practice the way that you want it to be. And that's something that, you know, we've really got to look at that. How serious are we? How serious are we doing this? Or are we just fundamentally, however sincere we may often feel, that we're just playing games with ourselves?
On these days, I felt my energy changed direction. Earlier, I was fighting against something, and now I feel my energy changed direction in fighting to reach something instead of fighting against something.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel...
You feel liberated in many ways.
Yeah, and I feel very thankful and happy for you and all.
Good. Well, that's because I think you stayed with something for a while, and then it's gone into change. And you're experiencing the fruit of that, and that's something for all of us to do, is to bear with and to stay with.
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking about you're saying about looping around looking for things, and I suppose in a way, like, I wanted to come on this retreat and, you know, have this experience, if you like, and is that a mistake? Because I feel that's it's been incredibly valuable.
Yes, that's right.
I put myself in a situation that has been quite tough at times, but at the same time, it's another form of practice.
Well, you've learned something about yourself, and you've learned, I mean, hopefully, whatever you've picked up here, if something's opened up for you here, you can take it to whatever you're committed to.
Well, I hope so, but I think again, in the sense I was wanting to come and try something. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. And is it part of that? You know, somebody saying about the sweet shop thing. I wanted to come here. I think I've had an intense experience, and I have. You know, and I feel I will take it back.
Yes.
But it is another. I brought another element into my practice.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think this often comes back to one of the basic, maybe the most basic principle that is needed to put in place in order to correctly put this practice in place is Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And if we're fortunate enough to have Buddha or a teacher, that will very much more likely to keep us in one place. This is why it's important to have a teacher, because that lack of a teacher of some sort of a spiritual authority that you trust is something again that's lacking a lot in the West, and people are looking for that, and this is what makes them go and try different things. But you know, if you have a teacher that you trust, that however, you know, these experiences can be useful, there's much less inclination, because that's like part of what we do. It's part of the journey, part of the path, is that we do go around testing lots of different things. But with a teacher, if we had a teacher that we trusted in the beginning, or as early as possible in practice, I think it's something that we're much less likely to do, because everything can be got from that sort of relationship in that sort of sangha. And that is a feature again. You know, this is a part of the thing of us moving around all the time, is that we don't seem to be able to find that person that we can surrender to, that we can trust and surrender to. And so we have this thing of spreading ourselves around a lot. And that's not traditional. It seems to be coming the Western tradition, but it's not traditional in Buddhism. But this is what we do.
Sort of carry on from that. It's not the Buddhist tradition, but the fact is that's where we are. This society is just now.
Yeah.
It's a very much a secular society. We've lost so much of our spiritual identity. So we're starting from that searching position. I feel so I'm just typical of my culture, in as much as I'm looking and I'm searching. And there's an awful lot of falsehood around, and there's an awful lot of, as you've pinpointed earlier in the week, and we have to be discerning. And there's this, it's a minefield.
Yeah.
And but that's the way it is.
Yeah. But then I'm, you know, somebody like me, or at least me, I'm coming along and just warning you of the dangers. That's all. You know, just warn the danger.
Can I just add something? Is it time?
Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to say that I've been lucky enough to go on a few Pure Awareness retreats, both within the FWBO and this retreat. And I've just learned such a lot from all of those people. And what I've noticed is that, I do feel that they are my teachers. And I've also noticed that different people have responded to different people, and different ones, and sort of felt, yes, I can really relate to this person, and I can really, you know, trust this person.
Sure.
And it seems that because there are different spiritual types or different types of people, that they respond to different people.
Absolutely.
That's not denying that, as the Kalamar Sutta, you know, says, that there are ways of sort of trusting, having a sense of trusting teacher rather than shopping around. I'm not being very clear, but
no. Well, you know, when you sort of pick the person who you trust, your teacher, and you think they're fantastic and they're just the one for you. For somebody else, they could be absolutely nothing at all.
Yes.
Which doesn't make them wrong.
Yeah.
Because it is an emotional connection, and you know, you connect with somebody, and as I say, somebody next to you has no connection at all with that person. That's why you need to find that connection. And if you do find that connection, that's where you settle. If you find that connection, that's where you should be settling. Because you can't have it, always. You can't go and get yourself half a dozen teachers that you have that sort of connection with, because you'll never do it. I mean, to find one is a blessing, and to make use of that connection, and to stay with that, That's the way it's always been done, and nobody suggested there are other ways. So if you do find somebody, then commit yourself to them, and then when it gets a bit difficult and you get a bit fed up, don't go running off somewhere else. Learn to stay with it. That's where it turns on, and this is where we are so conditioned in our culture that when we get fed up with something, we throw it away and get another one, because we got the money and we got the capability and the conditioning to do that. We throw it away and get another one. And you can't bring that to the Dharma. If you find somebody or something, then I believe you should commit yourself to that. And then just stay with it and bear with it. And then that will be the changing process that takes place.
There is always the possibility, remote maybe, but there is always the possibility that somebody sets themselves up as a teacher and can be quite convincing. And even take you in, and it's not until you have been with them for a while that it dawns on you that they are not the genuine teacher that you thought that they were. This is one of my fears, I must admit this, that I will choose somebody and then find my choice was completely wrong, I was deceived. Do you then change?
Well, if you lose trust in the person that you had trust in, then that is something serious. I would say in those, I mean, you know, these are difficult things, difficult experiences and difficult things to know what to do in. But I personally, talking from my own personal experience, I mean, I found the first Buddhist I ever spoke to was my teacher, and I just looked in her eyes and said, I want some of that. And this is my teacher, and I never went anywhere else. And I, you know, in hindsight, that was just amazing how that worked. I never thought twice about it at the time. And of course, you know, my teacher, there were a lot of qualities there. Whatever came out of the teacher, I thought was fantastic, and I just really just gave myself. But then when you're around the teacher, anybody long enough, you begin to see other things apart from the Dharma, the stuff that you want, and you actually slowly begin to discover they're actually a human being with the frailties and the imperfections that you've got. And that's very shocking, because the way they talk, you think that they've gone beyond all of that stuff and that they're some sort of a super being. That can be very, very difficult. That can be very traumatic. And they say, oh, I've made a mistake. Look at this. Wow, you know, and I discovered the sort of things that my teacher used to say and do and just act and be. I mean, nothing horrendously bad, but stuff that you wouldn't imagine somebody who's got all this wisdom could possibly, you know, be involved in. But, and you can take yourself this can be a real crisis. Because this person is not turning out to be the one that you've created. They haven't told you they're perfect. You've decided that they're perfect. So you've created this being that then begins to not be the person that you've created. And that they are actually just as human as what you are, actually. I mean, they still got their stuff, even though that the wisdom, I mean, this is the great sort of contradiction, the paradox with teachers, is that they have a lot of wisdom, but they also still have a lot of ignorance. That's the way it is. And you can become incredibly disillusioned by that. I mean, I would always suggest that you hang on and you learn to stay with that. And I know from my own experience, when I saw that, I learned to sift out. It was to focus on the bits that I wanted, so to speak, and learn to live with the stuff that I didn't want. And I think you have to do that. And as long as you can keep the faith in the stuff that took you there in the first place, then that's the reason to stay, and you learn such a massive lesson from that, that nobody's perfect, and they can be very wise and very loving, but also they can have other things that, you know, that can be very questionable. If you can retain that faith and that trust, then you stay with them. But if you lose that, if you don't have that respect for what they know, and you find out you've made the mistake, if you like, in the first, well, then you have to consider your position. But I don't think it's something that you do, like on the spot or compulsively. It's something that you have to sit with for a long time, because you do have to question yourself in this. Is it just me being restless? Is it me wanting to just, you know, wanting a change? Or is it really a breakdown of my relationship, a breakdown of my trust? And once you lose trust, you've lost it. It's gone. But I didn't feel like it wasn't, you know, it certainly didn't come from restlessness or anything, as I tried to touch on, was it yesterday, of learning to open up to myself more, that it was, that was for me clearly the next thing for me to do. There was absolutely no reaction whatsoever to my teacher or the group. In fact, I didn't want to leave, actually. I didn't want to go. I was perfectly happy, so there was no sense of that. It's just that for me, in that particular situation, I knew deep down that this is what I meant to be doing next, and that's why I went. It was through no restlessness or rejection, absolutely not. But it is it is a maturing. It is an understanding of how all of this works. That there is no such thing as perfection. People aren't perfect, teachers aren't perfect, and you have to learn to pick from them what you want. And if you see something that you don't like, as long as it's not too out of order, then you learn to live with it. And there's a great teaching there. There's a lot to be learnt out of that. That actually, you know, you are the create. You create the teacher. You create this being that's supposed to be something, you know, something special. And learn not to project, learn not to create, learn not to put people on pedestals. Because when you put them up there, you can guarantee that sooner or later they'll come crashing down. And then you invariably are the one that loses. You're the one that's going to walk away. You're the one that's going to miss out what they've got. And it is a great teaching. But that trust has got to be there. If the trust goes, then, well, it's just taking everything away from the relationship. It can't happen.
In my situation, I'm realizing more and more that I put my trust in an organization. Certain people, and it feels if there's any particular person I could sort of accept as a teacher, should I be looking for somebody within that organisation?
This is purely a personal quest, and it isn't about saying, you know, this person's a teacher and that person's a teacher or not a teacher or whatever. There's just a basic principle at stake in the practice of the Dharma, of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and that Buddha, you know, is symbolic of a teacher. And all traditions will tell you this. All traditions, in fact, it may be about the only thing that they agree on, is that you do need a teacher, and that teacher to be in place. Well, you know, traditionally they say 5 years, but of course that's down to the individual before you can sort of let them go and be able to get a sense of practice yourself. You know, that's how it, I mean, it might be an unpleasant reality, but that is the reality of it if you really want to walk the path. And it is important that you find somebody who you trust. I mean, whatever labels you want to hang around them, whatever their status may be or not be, you need somebody who you can trust, at least for a good while, who can set you, as it were, on the straight and narrow, who that you can open up to and trust, because you don't know the path. You think you might know, but you don't. And to get that orientation and to get you practicing in the correct way, that's the way it's worked. It's the way it's always been. And I think that's what you need to look for when you come to this. You need to look for a teacher. However you see that teacher, whatever, that's entirely a personal choice, decision. And that's the way it's always been done, and I don't question it for a moment.
So you're not saying it's necessarily a lifetime relationship?
Nobody knows the future, do they? I mean, you're dealing with something that's immediate now. I mean, you don't know how things are going to be in 10 years' time. I mean, your teacher may go and die on you. Mm. And then that's cat amongst the pigeons, isn't it? Teachers do die. I mean, I had two people. I mean, they weren't a teacher in the sense of my first teacher, but I had, who was my teacher in Sri Lanka, the one who inspired me and encouraged me to go to Sri Lanka. He went and died on me in the year. He wasn't there anymore. I didn't even know he died. Nobody told me. He died. So, you know, if I put all my eggs in that basket, I would have been. You know, that could have been quite a crisis. But so you know, everything changes. Everything's imperfect. You can't say, you know, this is for life. You feel that's what you need now, and hopefully you can commit yourself to that person for a good amount of time.
So it's like a living, working relationship.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, it might be that you still have that person in your heart.
Well, that can be in life, yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully. I mean, that's the ideal. I mean, that's not always possible. But the more contact that you can have, obviously, you know, your personal practice with that person who you trust has a far greater impact on you than if you do it, you know, through whatever other ways there are other than that personal contact. That's the ideal. I believe that's what we should be looking for. I really believe that if we're very serious.
I'm puzzling about this a bit because I did come across this other day. My first contact with Buddhism completely ignored by accident. And if there was a reason to hold offense to some particular teachers.
Yes, it's got a different way.
I have had particular people who have had a big impact on me. I spent a sort of bit of time at Lempa Abbey, and I heard one thing kind of Shudden said, which I thought was quite interesting. She was talking about how if you do, and she's talking in a particular context, she's saying if you do get a certain amount of insight, it's possible to think you've kind of done it, and which is something you might say, I think it's been several times before I've done it, but it's kind of like you get this sort of sense that you've done it, and if you don't have a teacher, you might just carry on thinking, well, I've done it. So she's saying, well, it's really, really crucial that you have a teacher at that point, because they can kind of give you a shove, basically. Mm. Exactly. Brings to your brother, I think, as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And
she
said, well, yeah, so it's absolutely necessary. But then she said, the trouble with a teacher is that it's like falling in love. You might not actually meet the teacher in this life.
Mm.
So you might not actually have a teacher.
Mm.
As you said, it's an emotional connection. It's not just, you know, looking it up on the phone.
Yes. Yeah.
So she's saying that, and then she's saying, well, if you don't have a teacher in this life, if you haven't had a teacher in this life, then what you need is a really, really strong sangha refuge and a really, really strong dharma refuge.
Mm.
And if those two jewels are strong in place, they will, you know, go to the bottom, kick you, because they'll kick out the bomb. Which I suppose has been to some extent in your, my experience, my connection with the sangha and dharma. But
well, if you say the bubble has burst with or without a teacher, then don't bother with the teacher. if you can find, if you say, if you put the other components in place, yeah, and the bubble is burst in the same way, then why bother with the teacher in the first place? Just put the Sangha in place, which is much easier to do, and have the Dharma and the Sangha put in place, which virtually anybody can do, put in place. The teacher is the problematical component, as it were. If they can both have the same end with all that, why bother with the teacher then? What you're saying there is that you can dispense with the teacher. No, that's right. No, I think it's true. You know, not everybody will meet their teacher, and what you do is you do your best. You put in place the best that you possibly can, which you know would be those other two parts. I mean, the Sangha, and you know you do your best. You do what your karma, what circumstances allow you to get together, to pull together. But the ideal is to find the teacher. But it's like a lot of things in life, isn't it? We can all wish and aspire to a lot of things, but we have to make do with, you know, substitutes, if you like. Yeah. But Buddhadhamma Sangha is the absolute crux of spiritual change.
Chanki Sutta deals, a very short sutta, deals with how to recognise your teachers. And it's mainly about gut feeling.
Sure it is, it's not intellectual, that's for sure. That's just nonsense, if that won't last 5 minutes. Mm.